Ukraine accuses Russia of launching a war of aggression as heavy fighting is underway in several Ukrainian cities. Iran blames NATO's provocations for the war in Ukraine and calls for a diplomatic solution to the crisis. And NATO says it condemns Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the strongest possible terms, calling it a blatant violation of international law. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. In Ukraine, heavy fighting is underway between pro-Russia militia and supporting Russian forces on the one side and the Ukrainian military on the other. Ukraine reports fighting is ongoing in almost all the entire country, including along the line of contact in eastern Ukraine. Ukrainian officials say some military command centers were hit in over 200 attacks carried out by the Russian side. Officials have so far put the death toll at around 70, including a dozen civilians. Kiev says as many as 50 Russian troopers have been killed in the fighting. Ukraine says some Russian forces have been taken prisoner in heavy fighting. Local officials say parts of Ukraine's southern Kherson region is no longer under Kiev's control. In the meantime, President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukrainian forces have dealt big blows to their adversaries. He called on Ukrainian citizens to come forward.
The Ukrainian armed forces are indeed involved in heavy fighting, repelling attacks in Donbas and other regions, east, north, south. The enemy sustained serious losses, and the enemy will sustain many more losses. They came on our land. We are already handing out weapons, and will hand them out to defend our country to everyone who wants and has the capacity to defend our sovereignty. The future of Ukraine depends on every citizen.
Ukraine has called on its allies to sever diplomatic ties with Russia and impose sanctions on the country. The fighting began early on Thursday after Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation to protect breakaway regions in Ukraine's Donbas. Moscow says it has no plans to occupy Ukrainian territory, but aims to neutralize Kiev's military potential and cleanse it of Nazis. Russia says its armed forces provide supporting fire to militia forces in eastern Ukraine to counter an offensive from Kiev's army. The Russian Defense Ministry says they have destroyed over 70 military targets in Ukraine. It says Russia is not targeting cities and the civilian population is facing no threats. The Kremlin says the length of military operation depends on how it will progress. Journalist and contributor Samuel Geddes says that the responsibility for the brewing crisis in Ukraine lies with the United States, NATO, and the Ukrainian government. He points the finger primarily at NATO, as they failed to roll back years of military expansion in Eastern Europe, which has been one of Russia's major concerns.
But I do think that quite a lot of the responsibility does also rest with the United States, its major NATO allies, and the government of Ukraine, that as soon as Russia made its concerns known and offered its own possible solutions, as I mentioned to you a few days ago, it was simply rejected. Obviously, Russia's main concern is the last 30 years of NATO expansion, and I think four waves of expansion that have happened while Vladimir Putin has been president, and the United States leading the NATO alliance effectively said the basis of your, the entire basis of your grievance is simply not up for discussion. So in that context, I don't really think it's surprising that we ended up here.
In the meantime, reactions keep coming in over the start of Russia's military operation against Ukraine. In a tweet, Iran's foreign minister blamed NATO's provocative moves for the situation. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that his country believes that resorting to war is not the right solution. He urged that efforts should be focused on working out a political and diplomatic solution, as well as establishing a ceasefire. Meanwhile, the Chinese foreign minister told his Russian counterpart that Beijing understands Moscow's reasonable security concerns. China earlier said Russia's military operation in Ukraine should not be referred to as an invasion. The European Union has also weighed in on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Brussels says that it will impose the most severe sanctions on Moscow.
We will weaken Russia's economic base and its capacity to modernize. And in addition, we will freeze Russian assets in the European Union and stop the access of Russian banks to European financial markets.
The European Union will respond in the strongest possible terms. President of the European Council, President Michel, has called for a meeting of the European Council this evening, and they will agree and provide political guidance to adopt the stronger package, the harshest package of sanctions we have ever implemented.
Now let's hear what the NATO Secretary General had to say about the Ukraine-Russia war.
This is a grave moment for the security of Europe. Russia's unjustified and unprovoked attack on Ukraine is putting countless innocent lives at risk. With air and missile attacks, ground forces and special forces from multiple directions, targeting military infrastructure and major urban centers. This is a deliberate, cold-blooded and long-planned invasion. NATO allies condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the strongest possible terms. It is a blatant violation of international law, an act of aggression against a sovereign, independent and peaceful country, and a serious threat to Euro-Atlantic security.
Our correspondent in London, Said Poreza, says a British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is expected to announce new sanctions on Russia in the coming hours.
We understand that the UK Prime Minister has held that famous COBRA meeting since this morning. We're yet to see what will come out of that. He will be heading to Parliament today to address the MPs, and we'll probably see a lot of demands coming from across the aisle in the British Parliament as to the next steps. And also, we understand that the Russian ambassador has been summoned to the UK Home Office.
As far as the European Union and the UK are concerned, yes, divisions in the way that they are approaching the escalation in Ukraine, but similar measures so far, such as the announcement of sanctions, and we're expecting more sanctions to be levied against Russia in today's announcement by the British Prime Minister. If you recall, he said Monday that was the first barrage, to borrow his own words, so the first tranche, as he said, of sanctions against Russian banks, as well as a number of three, to be exact, Russian billionaires close to the Kremlin.
As for whether or not there is unity among the members of the European Union,
there is distance between the kind of action or position they have taken on this whole issue.
Moving on, Iran's top security official says the Western parties engaged in the Vienna talks need to make political decisions to resolve key issues. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said the final conclusion will not be reached without resolving the remaining crucial issues. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says there has been considerable progress in the talks, thanks to Iran's initiative, and reaching a good deal is on the horizon. Separately, Iran's top negotiator in Vienna said the European sides need to make certain decisions in order for the discussions to produce the desired result. Ali Bagheri-Kani, in a tweet, called on the Europeans to adopt a balanced approach. Negotiating teams continue their discussions in the Austrian capital to reach a final agreement. Iran has said time and again that it will not compromise on the rights and interests of its people. And Beirut reacting to Israel's latest violation of the Lebanese airspace. President Michel Aoun condemns the regime's, quote, repeated violations of Lebanon's sovereignty, urging the United Nations to put a pressure on Tel Aviv to end such aggressions. He made these remarks during a farewell meeting with the outgoing head of the United Nations interim force in Lebanon. Aoun called for the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which ended Israel's 33-day war on Lebanon in 2006. The Lebanese president urged respect for his country's sovereignty. Israel repeatedly conducts airstrikes on targets in Syria throughout the Lebanese airspace. On Thursday, three Syrian soldiers were killed in an air raid near the capital, Damascus. Lebanon's interior minister has declared that the security forces of the country uncovered a Daesh-linked terrorist cell which was attempting to conduct simultaneous attacks on Shia religious targets in the Arab country. Miriam Saleh has more.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese internal security forces have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out three suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Helwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on three religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover internal security forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqis just 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell in the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Maulawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel has once again attacked Syria, and there have been casualties. A number of Syrian soldiers have been killed. These attacks have been happening repeatedly over the course of the past year, violating Syria's sovereignty without any action from the international community, not even condemnation. This is while Syria has been at the forefront of the battle against Daesh terrorists.
The Israeli regime has carried out yet another attack on the Syrian capital Damascus's countryside, killing three soldiers. Syria's state television carried the report early on Thursday, specifying the assault as a missile attack. Various media outlets had earlier reported that Syria's air defenses had confronted an Israeli airstrike around Damascus. The official Syrian Arab news agency Sana'a said a number of explosions had rung out over the skies of the capital and its outskirts. This is the Israeli regime's fourth attack on the Syrian soil within the space of just 2 weeks.
They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians.
Just a day earlier, the Arab country said the regime had launched a missile attack on various targets on the outskirts of Syria's southwestern city of Quneitra near Syria's Tel Aviv-occupied Golan Heights. Last week, the occupying regime targeted areas surrounding Damascus and the western city of Homs.
Well, Israel pays no attention to the international law. It doesn't even, I don't think, make a pretense of it. It violates international law every day in regard to the airspace of Lebanon, the airspace of Syria, the rights of the Palestinian people, and of course in its threats against Iran.
Israeli reasons for attacking Syria have been focused on its belief that Syria is arming Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, but on countless occasions, the strikes have targeted reinforcement belonging to Syria's military and its allies. Targeting of Syria and its allies like Hezbollah, who are fighting terrorists, have put into question Israel's intent on why it is targeting the ones responsible for getting rid of terrorists.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's continued occupation of the Golan. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as one of its launch pads for attacks against the Syrian soil.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In recent months, robberies have been more visible in the United States, with several involving large groups rushing into stores and coming out with armloads of goods. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Michael Corkery, Sapna Maheshwari, and Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, "Thefts, Always an Issue for Retailers, Become More Brazen." Stay with us for more. Flash mobs swarmed through a Nordstrom in Northern California and two Best Buy stores in Minnesota, running out with armfuls of merchandise. Five thieves steal $20,000 in products from an Ulta Beauty store in Pennsylvania in just 40 seconds. A security guard is fatally shot in Oakland, California, while working with a local television news crew, reporting about a recent retail robbery by a group of thieves. Theft is an ever-present issue for retailers in the United States. As much as $68.9 billion of products were stolen from retailers in 2019, according to one industry group. But it has become more visible, more brazen and violent in recent months, forcing an industry already buffeted by pandemic lockdowns and fights over mask requirements to deal with a new problem. This level of violence has taken it to a whole new level, says Rachel Michelin, president of the California Retailers Association. No one has seen this before. Luxury retailers in Union Square in San Francisco, the site of several high-profile robberies this year, have boarded up windows to prevent more mayhem. Best Buy warned last week that theft was lowering profit margins and said it was using QR codes for checkout in some areas so employees did not need to unlock items right away. Home Depot has hardened its stores, putting power tools and other valuables out of reach and advising employees not to film robberies with their mobile phones because it could escalate the situation. It has become second nature to take out your phone and record something when it is happening, said Scott Glenn, vice president of asset protection at Home Depot. But these people are getting violent. Retail executives and security experts link the thefts to a confluence of factors, but primarily the ease with which thieves have been able to resell stolen goods on internet in places in websites like Amazon and Facebook. But even industry veterans who have been tracking generations of shoplifters have been stunned by the methods and mindset of the thieves, saying they reflect a sense of impunity. Some recent robberies in which large groups rush into a store, overwhelm employees and flee in cars before the police can respond recall the looting that occurred across the country amid protests after the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. At that time, people took advantage of police departments stretched by the protests and ransacked hundreds of stores, including the Macy's in Herald Square and many smaller retailers, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. As tensions flared across the nation, major retailers like Nordstrom and Target would not discuss the extent of damage to their stores or how many they had to close during protests, instead focusing on their empathy for the demonstrators. The designer, Marc Jacobs, wrote on Instagram, "Never let them convince you that broken glass or property is violence. Property can be replaced, human lives cannot." With the unrest subsided, retailers are less reluctant to talk publicly about theft. Looting in general started during civil unrest, and it has now evolved, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, a trade group focused on crime at retailers. Criminal organizations saw during civil unrest that they were able to get their hands on millions of dollars of stolen products very quickly. The rise in thefts comes as punishments for retail theft have been broadly eased over the past decade. Since 2005, 30 states have increased the dollar threshold for theft offenses, which effectively means that fewer people are going to jail for smaller thefts, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. More than half of the states now have a felony theft threshold of $1,000 or more. The theft laws were changed to help reduce incarceration rates across the country, and some studies have found that the lower penalties have not led to more crime. And many of the most brazen crimes committed around Thanksgiving far exceeded the $1,000 threshold. Still, the thefts are being politicized, with some leaders saying they show the failure of decriminalization efforts. Others worry that the recent crimes could be used as a pretext to ratchet up penalties and incarceration rates again. Some industry experts say the problem is not necessarily the laws, but the lack of enforcement by the police and prosecutors, which emboldens enterprising thieves. a big priority, they say, should be breaking up the criminal organizations directing and profiting the most from the thefts. Ms. Michela, the head of the California Retail Trade Group, has been meeting with local prosecutors and the governor's office, which has established a task force on organized retail crime, trying to raise the urgency of prosecuting these cases. The level of organized retail theft we are seeing today is simply unacceptable, California's Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement. He added, businesses and customers should feel safe when doing their holiday shopping. Speaking to reporters on Friday, 3rd of December, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said federal law enforcement officials had been in contact with jurisdictions where we have seen this high level of retail theft. She added that the FBI was working with a task force led by the Los Angeles Police Department and that the Justice Department was providing money to hire 50 additional police officers in San Francisco, California. Both the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco have experienced high-profile retail robberies in recent weeks. Mr. Duggan, who has worked with a slew of major retailers and pharmacy chains like Walgreens, said that often the people snatching items are paid small fees like $500 for each robbery, which then feed larger enterprises that resell the goods online. Typically, these robberies don't involve large groups looting stores, but instead are smaller thefts that build up over time. One recent case, a 70-year-old man in Atlanta, Georgia, paid recovering drug addicts to steal razors and health products from stores like Target, CVS, and Publix and take them to his warehouse, according to court documents. The man, Robert Whitley, then sold the items online through businesses called Closeout Express and Essential Daily Discounts. He sold more than 140,000 items on Amazon's marketplace, totaling $3.5 million, according to federal prosecutors. Robert Whitley's lawyer said the thefts never involved violence. He said Mr. Whitley, who had struggled with drug addiction himself, ran support groups and provided shelter for others struggling with substance abuse. Robert Whitley, who pleaded guilty to one count of interstate transportation of stolen property, was sentenced in October to nearly 6 years in federal prison. His daughter, Nonnie Whitley, who was accused of being part of the illegal operation, was sentenced to 5 years' imprisonment. Similar cases have occurred from Katy, Texas, to Charlotte, North Carolina, and help explain why in many big-box chains and drugstores around the country, items like teeth whitening strips and razor blades are increasingly being put behind lock and key. Stolen goods used to show up at flea markets and pawn shops, but that has changed in recent years. One of the biggest issues that brick-and-mortar retailers have been grappling with is the rapid growth of online marketplaces where anyone can easily sell goods, often anonymously. Amazon, eBay, Facebook Marketplace, OfferUp, Etsy, all of those are utilized by illicit online sellers and they're allowed to get away with it because the illicit sellers are allowed to operate with anonymity on the internet, Mr. Duggan said. They don't have to list their real name or real addresses or location or their real banking information, so no one is concerned about being caught if they're not even using their real name. Consumers are often unaware of the provenance of items they're buying, but issues can emerge with products like baby formula, which can be expired or otherwise compromised when stolen. The anonymity reflects yet another instance in which criminals stymied by rules in the physical world can operate freely on the internet, an issue that has surfaced in problems involving misinformation, questionable advertisements, and merchandise glorifying crimes. Pawn shops, for example, are regulated in almost every state, said Richard Rossman, a sergeant with the Broward County Sheriff's Office in Florida, who is also part of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. The coalition of law enforcement and retail has gotten support from industry groups and retailers, including pharmacy chains Home Depot and Ulta Beauty, on partisan legislation known as the Informed Consumers Act. The bill would require online marketplaces to authenticate the identity of high-volume third-party sellers, including their bank account information and tax identification, and allow consumers to see basic identification and contact information for those sellers. Etsy, OfferUp and eBay said they support the legislation after opposing a draft of the legislation that raised privacy and safety concerns for sellers. Meta said that Facebook Marketplace users could report items they thought were stolen and that law enforcement could contact the company regarding suspicious items. Amazon said in a statement that we regularly request invoices, purchase orders and other proofs of sourcing when we have concerns about how a seller may have obtained particular products that they want to sell. Amazon added that it employed 10,000 people working to prevent fraud and abuse on its site and supported the Informed Consumers Act.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Orile and Robert Matanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Orile enter international marathons, while Matanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but as we see in this documentary, it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion-dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context, and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. His little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing, I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes...
Which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York, you could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Valeev, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there, but, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
Today marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
As in late 1993, I heard about Tekla.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arelia Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve... they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. This guy's a people organizer. And of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in the marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Liv, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gunrunners, which shows Robert Mutanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you'll be in a hot soup. Look outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes, athletics.
The odds 1 out of 10 that you can make money out of it. And 1 in 50 to really make money out of it if you start really changing your life. The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial. There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in Ite. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Arile. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Arile's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Arile is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here. But it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. And what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete, and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's old town square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, and then, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it and stuff. So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Absolutely. The journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. And later on, he's now got three wives with, and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly, you know, more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way, in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.